You are listening to Speak Up Arkansas with Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families. On the second half of the show, we will be joined by two of Governor Hutchinson's juvenile justice advisors on some major reforms to the juvenile justice system that will soon roll out. But first, we are joined by Jenny Blankenship, Education Policy Director at Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families, and Christian Adcock, an attorney at Disability Rights Arkansas, to discuss school discipline policies in Arkansas and how certain policies should be updated to reflect newer research on behavior and discipline. Thank you both for joining us today. Can you start by introducing yourself and telling us a bit about your work and the work of your organization?
Sure. This is Jenny Blankenship, Education Policy Director for Arkansas Advocates, as you already said. And we have worked on school discipline issues at Arkansas Advocates for a number of years. We recently released a report called School Discipline That Works in January. And it's actually an update of some work that we did back in 2014. And just to make a long story short, we found that unfortunately a lot of things have not changed since then. In fact, some things have gotten worse. We've found that there's more and more new research coming out that provides some better solutions for kids. And it kind of reemphasizes the need to pay attention to how a lot of our outdated discipline policies are really having a disproportionate effect on children with special needs.
I'm Christian Adcock. I'm with Disability Rights Arkansas. I'm actually not an attorney. I'm an advocate there. We provide free legal and advocacy services for people with disabilities. Our work often involves issues that stem from, you know, issues with special education or physical abuse. And so corporal punishment kind of ties those two together, as well as you do see we focus a lot on the school to prison pipeline as well.
And so Jenny, you kind of gave an idea of what was in the report, but can you talk about the major findings in Arkansas Advocates' new school discipline report?
Yes, and what we found in Arkansas is really consistent with what other people have found around the country. We're still over-relying on out-of-school suspensions. We're giving some pretty harsh punishments to very minor infractions, and that's making kids get further behind in school. Every time we send a child home or even send to in-school suspension, that's time that they're losing in the classroom on making progress academically and with their reading skills. So, you know, a lot of groups came together with the Arkansas Department of Education 2 years ago to form a task force on school discipline. Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families was pleased to be invited to participate in that task force. We had a lot of really good conversations. I think there's a lot of widespread agreement among different stakeholders about the problems. And we're still kind of wrestling with some of those solutions. So, you know, there's always going to be a tension between, you know, mandating certain changes versus wanting to preserve kind of local control and letting local school boards and parents and communities make decisions about different policies. And I certainly understand that. But everyone at the table seems to agree that we're just kicking too many kids out of school unnecessarily. Now, what I want to make very clear is that no one is saying that kids should not face consequences. Clearly kids need the, you know, direction and then the freedom to make mistakes and learn from them and then face the consequences accordingly. So no one is trying to take discipline out of schools. We're just trying to get people to think a little bit more critically about how to do it. And the things that, you know, we used to rely on 30, 50, 60 years ago, we're finding that they just don't work. And one of the things that we've tried to champion over the past couple months is the issue of corporal punishment. So I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about some legislation that's been proposed later in the show.
How common is corporal punishment and suspension in Arkansas?
Suspensions are very common, but I think people are first of all, still shocked to learn that Arkansas still allows corporal punishment at all. We're one of only 19 states in the United States that still allow it in some form. And we allow it to be used on any kind of student, including students with severe cognitive disabilities, physical limitations, and things like that. So that's been the first response that I've received from a lot of people when I go out and talk about this is they're shocked that we still do it. In the 2017-2018 school year, students were subjected to corporal punishment over 15,000 times. That's a total number of incidents. So some of those kids, may have experienced that more than once. So the good news is that when you go back and look at the data from the Department of Education, the number of times that corporal punishment has been used has dropped dramatically over the past 10 years. So it used to be over 80,000 incidents every year, which is a little hard to believe, but we've made a lot of progress. So people are kind of naturally relying on that method less. But 15,000 incidents is still greater than zero, and we don't think that's good for kids.
You're listening to Speak Up Arkansas, and we are talking about school discipline. If you have a question for our guests, you can give us a call at 433-0088. And what are the impacts of these traditional school discipline techniques, corporal punishment and suspension, and if Christian, you can talk about it from a perspective of students with disabilities in particular.
Well, generally, corporal punishment, and there's a raft of studies that back this up, the impact is that corporal punishment doesn't do what it's supposed to do. There's research that shows more often children receive corporal punishment, the more likely they are to become aggressive and misbehave over time. And when you're talking about students with disabilities who may be, if you have an intellectual disability or a student on the autism spectrum, they're going to have difficulties with processing and regulating emotions and with communicating their needs effectively. And a lot of the time that can look like misbehaving. It can look like acting out. And so there's actually research that shows that students with disabilities are more likely to receive corporal punishment than other students in school districts where it's used. And so the long-term effects can be wide-ranging, but you do have to look at things like, oftentimes students with disabilities will have trauma in their background. And if you have something like corporal punishment, which is inherently violent, you can re-traumatize these kids. You can cause them to regress behavior-wise and just development-wise. There's really, I have yet to find a good argument for the use of corporal punishment for children with disabilities. Because like I said up front, it does not do what it's supposed to do and what proponents of it will say it does. It doesn't straighten anyone out. It doesn't teach them anything. It just makes things worse.
Same. He just summarized that section of my report very nicely. So thank you.
Christian, what are some other common problems that you see with school discipline regarding children with disabilities?
With children with disabilities, you also run into issues revolving around restraint, seclusion. Oftentimes, restraint is overused. It can be used in its, I don't want to say best form because there is no best form, but restraint is supposed to be used as a way to, as a therapeutic tool for students that may need it, for, like I said, students that can't regulate their behavior or actions the way that, students without disabilities can. oftentimes restraint is just interchangeable with punishment. You have all the inherent dangers that come with a grown adult trying to wrestle a child. And you can find it on our website. We released a white paper a few months back. I can't remember exactly how long, and I'll probably hear about that from my coworkers. But we released a white paper talking about the use of restraint and seclusion in schools and the myriad of reasons why it's a bad idea and how it can go wrong, from simple stuff like grabbing a child by the arm all the way to, you know, face down prone restraint on the floor to, you know, calm them down, which I can't think of anyone who's going to be calm by having another person sitting on top of them. But, you know, some people still like to do that. That has a lot of the same sort of knock-on effects as corporal punishment does, where, you know, it leads to more aggression and more acting out and regression and trauma. And, you know, eventually it goes into, it's a big part of, you know, eventually that leads to expulsion. And then you're looking at, like I mentioned earlier, the school to prison pipeline, where maybe not necessarily prison, but students are, the end of the road is institutionalization of some sort.
It is a great report, and it just reminded me, we should share that on Arkansas Advocate's website as well, because that's another issue that I think people just aren't aware of. And I think the problem is usually not that a teacher or administrator is trying to punish or harm a child in some way. A lot of it just stems from the fact that they don't have enough trained staff to handle children with special needs. We have a severe shortage of special education teachers, social workers, school counselors who can help mitigate some of the behavior problems and provide more support to students and their families. So sometimes it's just people are acting out of desperation, and that's not to excuse it, but just to remind people that we've got to invest in people if we want to have better outcomes for kids. So
isn't there some legislation on the table to allow counselors to have more time to work with kids and kind of limit their duties?
Yes, it's already been signed by the governor, I believe, and I don't know the act number offhand, but previously school counselors were only supposed to spend, I believe, 70% of their time, or supposed to spend no less than 70% of their time at school working one-on-one with students and addressing their usual needs instead of just focusing on paperwork and test administration and things like that. And I believe this new act bumps that up to about 90%. So only 10% of their time is supposed to be devoted to test administration and things of that nature, which is very good because we already vastly over exceed the recommended ratios for students to school counselors in Arkansas. The follow-up question to that legislation is, how are we going to provide more support for schools to take on more test administration? Because as any educator can tell you, that takes up an awful lot of time in schools now.
And you're listening to Speak Up Arkansas with Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families. We are talking about school discipline. If you have a question for a caller, you can give us a call at 433-0088. And so we've talked about some ineffective ways we have a caller. You're on the air?
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Hi, I've been a teacher in Arkansas for a couple of years now, and I'd be curious to get your panel's thoughts on the type of punishment, like including physical exercise, like wall sits or push-ups. Does that fall under the category of corporal punishment, or any other creative ways that they might suggest?
Thanks.
Okay.
Thank you for your call.
I don't think that that's typically considered corporal punishment. I can speak as a parent that my own 7-year-old boy has been subjected to that punishment very recently. I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing, but sometimes teachers have to be creative and use their best judgment about what works for individual kids. I don't know if that would be appropriate for a child with special needs, certainly.
I think a lot of that would come down to sort of the individual aspects of how it was administered, what the punishment was for, that sort of thing. I'm really not sure if I can give a blanket answer to that one.
Yeah, and I will say that if it's done with the right intention and the right spirit, it actually could be quite helpful, because we know that kids are getting less and less recess and physical education time now. They don't have as much time to run and get out their frustrations and their energy. So sometimes we need to give them more opportunities to move their bodies, because that gets your brain flowing, and then you can come back to class with a clearer head and be ready to focus. And a lot of people laugh at me when I say this, but there is a lot of research now that shows that things like guiding students through meditation or yoga exercises is really effective in changing school culture and getting kids back on track with minor misbehaviors. So, you know, that's something that a lot of schools are starting to experiment with now, even in Arkansas. I know Jonesboro has a school that has drastically cut their disciplinary incidents after implementing a meditation program, just kind of giving kids a chance to chill out and understand how to stop and take a breath and think through their actions.
And what are some other positive school discipline techniques, and are there any that would be specific to children with disabilities?
A lot of the issue you run into with children with disabilities is that there isn't really a great one-size-fits-all approach, but these are issues that should be addressed in the child's individualized education plan, where they talk about, which is, it's a plan when you have a student in special education. It's a plan that sort of tailors school to them as far as on every level. It should cover every level, but as far as, you know, behavior redirection and that sort of thing, and what to do in certain circumstances if a child's just having a meltdown, you know, how to handle that. But it's really, because you're dealing with things like what a child's triggers are going to be, and that's going to be different for every kid. And so it's real hard to do a one size fits all. Although there has been, again, I hate to go back to it, but there has been research into the value of things like meditation and yoga and mindfulness and that sort of thing, as far as not so much for after the fact, but to sort of reduce those behaviors in the first place. But it's all going to be very much tailored to the individual child.
Jenny, in this school discipline report, did it outline some positive school discipline techniques that would be able to be widely used?
A lot of schools have had success with something called restorative justice, and that's one of those, you know, big education phrases, which just means kind of peer mediation and giving kids a chance to make it right whenever they've done something wrong, to upset someone or hurt someone in class. I mean, it's usually not used with, severe violent offense or things like that. But if you have kids that are arguing in class all the time, instead of just sending them to detention where they sit there and do nothing, restorative justice kind of is a way to train teachers to work with students to work out their problems themselves and actually gain some life skills that they can use in school and beyond. Take responsibility for their actions and make it right. So a lot of schools are doing a lot of that. I know the Little Rock School District has had success in using restorative justice practices. Another thing that's commonly used with elementary school students is conscious discipline. That is outside my area of expertise, but I know that it's just a more thoughtful approach to dealing with kids and helping them to recognize their emotions in the moment and identify what they're really feeling, and then think more mindfully about how to react and kind of redirect them in a positive way instead of just always in a punitive way, you know, always resorting to spanking or always resorting to taking away recess or sending a kid home.
And it sounds like for all of those techniques, it seems like those do provide life skills to teach children how to handle anger and other emotions in adulthood.
They do, but they take more time. And that's why, you know, I follow up all of these conversations by saying we've got to invest in more highly trained school counselors, school psychologists, and social workers to help teachers manage their own classrooms and keep everyone else on track, but also help those kids get those life skills they need at the same time.
So Arkansas Advocates is supporting a bill, SB 381. Can you talk about what that bill would do?
Yes, Senator Joyce Elliott and Representative Deanne Vaught have come together to introduce legislation this session which would prohibit public schools from using corporal punishment on students with certain special needs. So it wouldn't apply across the board to anyone receiving special education services, but they've kind of specified the language to apply to kids who have autism, maybe nonverbal or non-ambulatory, which means they may be confined to a wheelchair or have some sort of serious cognitive disability. So they're not, you know, maybe able to function in a regular school setting the way that a lot of other kids are able to do. So that's all that the bill would do. It would just take that authority and also the burden off of our public schools and charter schools to have to use that as a method of teaching and redirecting our most vulnerable kids. What it would not do is try to tell parents what to do in their own home. No one's trying to do that, and no one's trying to let, you know, any kids run wild. We're just trying to use some more research-based methods to do things better, and starting with the kids who really need us to advocate for them the most.
The great thing about this bill is that it doesn't do anything and it doesn't have any goals that the state haven't already pretty much endorsed. The state operates therapeutic foster homes throughout the state. The state operates throughout the state. Therapeutic foster homes.
That's good.
Which these foster homes are for children with disabilities, children with, you know, heavy trauma backgrounds, with, you know, who have trouble regulating their emotions. And in order to be a foster parent in one of these foster homes, you have to receive a lot of extra training to deal with these students or children. And crucially, corporal punishment of any kind is not allowed in therapeutic foster homes. And this has been going on for years. And the state already realizes that corporal punishment is not the best way to discipline these kinds of children. And so it really seems like a no-brainer to me, and I'm guessing to everybody else here, to extend that to the classroom.
And are there any other policies that you think would help address some issues around school discipline and create more effective policies to improve behavior and outcomes for kids?
Doing away with restraint and seclusion completely. Mm-hmm. And really doing away with corporal punishment completely, but baby steps.
Agreed. It's been an ongoing issue, and it's time.
And can you, to wrap up, any final thoughts? And if you could give your web addresses and let people know how to get a hold of you.
Yes. You can find our report on Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families website at www.aradvocates.org. You can also see a link to the Arkansas Department of Education's Task Force on School Discipline's recommendations. I'm very grateful that that task force adopted almost everything that I recommended. Yay! So I was honored to be a part of that work and happy to still be working with all of those groups involved to make good things happen for kids. So thank you.
You can find the white paper I mentioned earlier, along with several other reports that we've put out, at disabilityrightsar.org. We also have a Facebook and a Twitter. I think we might have an Instagram. I'm not sure. And you can reach us by phone if you have any questions about anything related to disabilities. We can, if what I like to say is usually if we can't help you, we can point you in the direction of somebody who can. And
you do help parents.
Yes, we do work with parents. That phone number is 1-800-482-1174.
Well, thank you all for being here today. Oh, Jenny, I have one more thing.
Oh, I just wanted to note that Senate Bill 381 about corporal punishment will be introduced in Senate Education Committee next Wednesday at 10 a.m.
Get there early if you want to get a seat. but thank you both for joining us today. We'll be back in just a minute to talk about new juvenile justice reforms.
This is KABF in Little Rock, 88.3, the voice of the people in Central Arkansas.
KABF and Speak Up Arkansas would like to thank our underwriters, Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families, the Arkansas Education Association, Arkansas Children's, and the Arkansas Coalition for Peace and Justice, all supporting KABF, the voice of the people.
You are listening to Speak Up Arkansas, and we are back for the second part of our show. We are joined by Betty Gooman with the Office of Legislative and Intergovernmental Affairs of Arkansas at the Department of Human Services. That's really long. I don't envy you having to tell people that. And Keisa Smith, Deputy Director at the Arkansas Department of Human Services, much easier. They are both part of Governor Hutchinson's team that have been working on juvenile justice reforms. Thank you both for joining us today. Do you want to start by introducing yourself and telling us a bit about your work?
I'm Betty Gooman. My background is that I have worked in child welfare and juvenile justice for a number of years. Most recently, I was director of youth services, Division of Youth Services. Before that, I worked for Governor Hutchinson as a child welfare advocate. I have a background in social work and have been involved in reform efforts for a number of years in the state.
And my name is Keisa Smith, and I also have with us today our Interim Division of Youth Services Director, Michael Crump, and our new Deputy Director for DYS, Kimberly Newsom, who is on day two of her job.
Welcome.
But I am the Deputy Director over Youth and Families for DHS. That makes me over four divisions within the agency, juvenile justice being one of those divisions, but also child welfare and child care and early childhood education, along with services for the blind.
Well, it sounds like you have your hands full too. Today was a really great day. Governor Hutchinson signed Act 189, the Restoring Families Act. Can you talk a bit about that law and what the major parts of it are?
Yes, this law is the culmination of work over a number of years, particularly the last year, where two groups of advocates got together and worked really hard on coming up with legislative options. The Youth Justice Reform Board and the Supreme Court Commission on Children, Youth, and Families. The basic premise is that juveniles, that we're keeping too many juveniles in secure out-of-home placements. We're trying to keep juveniles who have had issues with the courts, mostly delinquency, misdemeanor, or felony offenses, keep them in the communities and treated in the communities. For most youth who commit serious crimes, they are committed to the Division of Youth Services for an indeterminate time, and Kisa can talk to you about that. But what we're trying to do is to work on some programs that would divert youth early on in their dealings with the juvenile court from being committed to DYS to remaining in the community. So that means reducing the number of secure out-of-home placements or incarceration and increasing the number of community-based youth services. This particular bill is very significant in that for the first time, I think, the judges were very involved in developing new approaches. Mm-hmm. Based on this bill, all juveniles who come into contact with the juvenile court, or all juvenile courts, are required to do diversion agreements to consider if there are ways to treat the youth in the community first. The second thing that's most critical is that before youth can be committed to the division, they have to have a validated risk assessment. And that risk assessment has to show whether they're low, medium, or high risk to reoffend. If a juvenile has committed a misdemeanor and is low risk, they cannot be sent to the division. They need to be treated in the community. So that's a real major change. Kisa will talk about some changes within DYS, particularly that as DYS looks at reducing the number of secure placements, there should be some savings that are identified. If we close two facilities like we're doing, there should be some savings, and that money needs to be redirected to community programs and to increasing services for youth who are in the residential area. So just one last thing about the bill, and then we'll get to Kisa. This was a time where judges, the Division of Youth Services, and the community-based providers and advocates, such as Arkansas Advocates, all came to the table and talked about all the various things that could be done. And all together, we agreed on this, a few things to get started with. Mm-hmm. So the bill has things about the courts, it has things about DYS, and it has things about community-based programs. So it was an effort where everyone came together and agreed. And in the past, we've had a lot of disagreement when legislation got to the legislature and we were fighting about things. This time, we were all together. And the governor did make it a priority, and that was very helpful.
All right. Well, and I think that Betty hit all the high notes. So there is not a whole lot to add. As Betty noted, the biggest portion of this bill was pertaining to the validated risk assessments. And we're extremely appreciative of the judiciary coming out and having and being willing to take it upon themselves to add that requirement, and also to shepherd, saying that that is something that all of the juvenile judges across the state are going to do by the implementation date. As Betty noted, the second part, which was on the agency, was a commitment from us to say that we are invested in community-based services mm-hmm. for children to have more options to stay in their home and receive the services they need to stay out of ever coming into our system. And so what we said was that in the next 2 years, we are going to make a concerted effort to create a plan that shows how we are going to put more money into the community. And that may happen in various different ways. Betty noted that one of the parts of our agency's transformation plan was that we are closing two facilities. Now, those are facilities that we don't believe are going to net us a significant amount of savings mm-hmm. By closing. But what we do believe is that it shows a sign that judges have done their part in terms of making a commitment to not send children into DYS custody. And we are going to do our part by, if we don't need those beds, then we're not going to keep those facilities open, and showing them that we are really committed to making sure that children get services in the community. We also, this bill, the third part is also that community-based providers are going to ensure that the services that they provide are evidence-based, are mm-hmm. evidence-informed, so that we're not just doing programs that feel good, but programs that have been shown to actually have an impact on our youth.
And you're listening to Speak Up Arkansas with Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families. We are talking about new juvenile justice reforms that the governor just signed, had the official bill signing today. If you have questions for our guests, you can give us a call at 433-0088. And so, Director Smith, you were talking about how this will create a two-year plan. Can you talk a bit more about what that would look like too? And this also would help create personalized plans for each of these children, correct?
Correct. And actually, you know what? I'm going to give Director Crump the opportunity to jump in and equally so that he can talk about all of the work that DYS has been doing in order to ensure that we begin to do individualized treatment plans for our youth when they come into the system.
Sure, thank you. Actually, that's a big part of what we're doing. We're bringing more behavioral health clinicians. We're bringing a multidisciplinary team that we've never really had in place before to do, as you mentioned, the individualized treatment plans. In the past, admittedly, we've not done a good job of really addressing that individual child's needs. So what we're looking to do is bring a team, bring more of the stakeholders that maybe have been involved down the road, maybe when they exit a facility or whatever the stage may be in their treatment. They might get a child and not really know what's been going on with them, what kind of treatment they've been getting, what their needs really are, mm-hmm. until the child comes into to the handoff to them. We want to bring all of those stakeholders in at the beginning, make sure that they're involved in the process and that we're getting feedback from them as well. So every child is getting that individualized treatment, and not just the treatment, but that we're scheduling and we're periodically reviewing their progress. So if there happen to be incidents or setbacks or the treatment that we've prescribed is not working, maybe they're having educational problems, whatever that may be, we can refer that child back to that original treatment team with the behavioral health clinicians, the educators, the community-based providers that are helping us, and come up with a new plan. And so they will also be reviewing to see if, you know, if the progress is good enough that child's ready to re-enter the community as well.
So they'll have a primary caseworker or something who's watching all of that?
Correct. They'll have a caseworker or a case manager type that's helping them through the process, guiding them through the process, keeping up with that, with their progress, and giving that information back to this team that has more professionals that are involved in the treatment plan itself.
And do you kind of have a good idea of what you think the primary needs of a lot of the kids will be?
You know, I'm not a behavioral health clinician by training. I'm actually an attorney, so don't hold that against me. But we just want to bring those things into place so mm-hmm. those individuals can make the kind of recommendations. Our new contract for oversight over these facilities will have more on-site therapy or therapists to be able to help with those services. But we want to be able to redirect more money into that area as well. So the educational part, we're looking into providing more vocational opportunities. Some of our children that may have a GED already, so they're not really looking to reintegrate back into their high school. We need to start working on more programs for them so that they're ready to go back into society and not reoffend when they get out as well.
Mm-hmm. And what sort of services are currently available to kids in DYS custody? And obviously this is a big change, but how drastic of a change is it?
I'd say there's going to be a change as far as the type of services and the amount of services available, but the real change isn't so much that those services aren't available right now. Mm-hmm. It's more of DYS has to do a good job sort of cleaning up our house and making sure we're not letting that kid slip through the cracks and not really get the services they need in the amount of time that is needed. We've heard that from a lot of judges. It's about the proper dosage of treatment. It's about not letting them languish too long in a facility long past the productive time of their treatment to where maybe they're becoming a little bit institutionalized. Mm-hmm. So we'd like to get them back out into the community once they've received the proper amount of treatment. I mean, we'll have sex offenders and different types of delinquents that, you know, need different types of services, but it's really about making sure they're getting the right length, the right amount of treatment, so they can go back into the community.
And isn't it so the validated risk assessment will have different risk levels of children, and you'll decide kind of then if community-based care is more appropriate versus going in DYS services?
Correct. Some children, based on their validated risk assessment, will be there for a much shorter period of time than others, because if they're lower risk, they don't need necessarily as many services before they're ready to go back into the community. Or, you know, there may be some that we're able to place in a group home type setting or something a little short of our, you know, our secure facilities that you see.
Mm-hmm. And was there a specific motivation behind why DYS and DHS and the governor felt that this path needed to be taken?
Well, you know,
I was going to defer to Peace on that
one. You know, we often tell the story about the governor's first day in office. When Governor Hutchison was elected, the very first day we got a call, and he stated that he wanted to go out to the Alexander facility and do a site tour, and he wanted a staff member who was well versed in direct care services to tour with him, because at that time when he took over, there were lots of stories pertaining to problems at our juvenile facilities, allegations of staff on youth incidents, and also allegations that children were fighting amongst themselves. And the governor said on the onset that seeing actual change within the juvenile justice system was a priority for him. He recognized that for many, many years, juvenile justice had been flat funded in Arkansas. And so we were really kind of treading water as it relates to making any we did not have the ability to financially make the changes that we wanted to make in the behavioral health system, because we were always trying to ensure that we kept the residential system the way that at the standard that it should have been. And the governor made it very clear and was always supportive of us bringing him the ideas about what needed to change in the system, and has been very supportive of us going to the drawing board and saying, you know what, for our system to be successful, these are the changes that we need to make.
I'd also add that it's important to realize that the way our system is set up, DYS does not provide these services directly. We mm-hmm. have been recently, but that's unusual. So we contract with providers to do the secure residential facilities and the community-based programs. And so DYS then becomes the group that needs to monitor and oversee and have really good policies and procedures, standards, lessons learned. So I think that what you'll see in the transformation plans for DYS is becoming more of oversight and making sure that we have the foundation for doing services that are evidence-based and best practices. And I think the the governor saw that as well. So there's a lot of transformation going on with NDYS right now, but it's all based on best practices and lessons learned and a whole system of behavioral health and trauma-informed practice and all those things that we wanted to do for a long time. And now I think we are in a position of doing that. And you'll see that we are in the process of redoing almost all DYS policies. Those have to be promulgated. So there's going to be a lot of input into those things.
And promulgated means just decide on the rules.
Those have to be presented to the legislature and approved. Mm-hmm. So things like length of stay or things like how long we hold kids in a secure placement or confinement, what kind of services we're providing for families. Mm-hmm. The focus on the family is another big, big change for us, that we know that as soon as a youth is committed to DYS, somebody needs to be working with the family to get the family ready for that youth to go back in. That's our community side. Mm-hmm. And then our residential side has the individualized treatment that Michael mentioned for that individual youth.
So when any law is passed, it goes to the relevant department and they kind of figure out they get down in the weeds and figure out exactly how it'll be implemented. And
yes. Right. There's a lot more work to do. I mean, today was great to get the bill passed, but there's a lot of work to do from the judicial side, the juvenile courts, and from DYS and advocates for making sure it happens.
Absolutely.
And you mentioned trauma. What percentage of children in DYS custody do you think have experienced trauma? Do you have a...
We would be speculating to give an exact number. However, I mean, we know that several of our youth have experienced trauma in their background. And let's not ignore the fact that being arrested, yes, being charged, going before a judge, all of those things are traumatic, and every last one of them have experienced that. Yes. So, I mean, that's a different level of trauma, but all of them have found themselves in a situation that they would likely prefer not to be. And so we are cognizant of that.
And there are best practices in how you deal with youth and adults who have gone through trauma, and we're seeing that, and we're beginning to build that into all of our programs.
And you're listening to Speak Up Arkansas with Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families. We are talking about new juvenile justice reforms, and we are about to start talking about the transformation process, a small part of it at least. If you have a question for our guests, you can give us a call at 433-0088. So the transformation is underway, and it's really big, and it affects all aspects of this state government, but can you talk about how it would affect DHS, DYS, and well, not all of DHS, that's really big, but in relation to juvenile justice?
So the governor's transformation plan, right?
Yes.
It's for state government. Yeah.
Yes, the governor is this is one of his big things for the session. Mm-hmm.
And I only clarify because there were some changes that DYS is undergoing at the same time that we're having the big, large state government transformation plan as well. But DHS didn't have a whole lot of changes made to it through the governor's transformation plan, namely because there was recognition of how large our agency was to begin with. Mm-hmm. We actually have, at any given time, are about 7,300 employees in every county of the state. But the thing that we did get added to our agency is that currently the Department of Military runs what is called the C-STEP program. And it's mirrored closely to the Youth Challenge program, but the difference is that Youth Challenge participants are able to elect to come into the program, whereas C-STEP children are sent there by the courts. And so the military department has very specific guidelines for how they run the Youth Challenge program that's set forth by the National Guard. Mm-hmm. And so they talked to the Governor's Transformation Board and said, we really think that the C-STEP program, because of the court involvement, is better suited for DYS. And we agreed because one of our heavy focuses and the changes that we're making to DYS is pertaining to diversion. Mm-hmm. And we strongly believe that the C-STEP program, which is really patterned after a boot camp program, gives children a short-term opportunity. It's only about 6 to 8 weeks, but gives them an opportunity to experience something different, but also recognize the consequences of their actions and hopefully make a change without having to come into DYS custody.
So is that something that might be part of that child's personal plan, or is that something totally different?
It's a little different because at that point of time, the focus on individual treatment plans is a DYS activity. Mm-hmm. And at that point of time, they would have been sent directly from the courts. But we are looking at ways in which we can integrate individualized treatment for our youth, even when they are in diversion programs. Mm-hmm. So we are definitely looking at ways in which even those children, even though they are only with us for a short period of time, can equally get treatment that will make their time with us more productive.
Let me just say, I was talking with several judges today, and they mentioned the C-STEP program as being something that they wanted more of. And they were saying, you know, we're just judges, and yet we have to figure out what to do with these kids. You know, mm-hmm. we do a needs assessment and that kind of thing, but other than sending them to DYS, the judges were saying, we're not qualified to do a treatment plan.
Yeah.
So something like C-STEP is a good option.
And just to give you a little bit background on C-STEP, it's the Civilian Student Training Program. Yeah. I think it's around 350 children a year go through that. So I think the distinction that we need to make is those are not children that have been committed to DYS. It's those that a court has ordered them to go there. It's sort of, in my experience, has been sort of a last resort. I'm going to give you a chance to go to this boot camp. So
is it like driving school if you get a ticket, or is it more
it's more along the lines of a child has reached the point where the judge can probably see that commitment is in their future, and possibly depending on their age, they might end up in the adult system. So they're trying to give them a short-term opportunity to go to this shorter program to try mm-hmm. to correct their behavior. And we're kind of hoping that once this transitions to us, that we can also bring in some of the resources that we have that they may not have the military department, because we're such a big agency, as Kisa described, that we might have those same behavioral health and education resources that we might be able to bring to bear on that population as well.
And this doesn't have to deal directly with juvenile justice, but I think it does kind of show the governor's thinking behind these issues. His Restore Hope initiative focuses both on reentry and child welfare, and child welfare is one of our Arkansas Advocates founding issues that they worked on. Would you say it's fair to say that the governor sees child welfare and reentry as connected? And
well, that's it. what I think the governor sees as it relates to Restore Hope and the child welfare population, along with the reentry population, because mm-hmm. reentry would be individuals coming out of prison, is that is two populations that are vulnerable populations, mm-hmm. and individuals that he knows that with the proper support can definitely live productive lives. And what we have seen is that if our children in the child welfare system do not get the services that they need, but also just community support and a sense of family and a sense of individuals helping them as they transition to adulthood, then they have the tendency to get into trouble and get into areas that we wouldn't want them to get into. And so what Restore Hope says is that they're there to help wrap around and provide those and help to provide these services, just like individuals that are coming out of prison and need services, and for individuals to give them a chance in order to live productive lives.
So. And I actually worked on the Restore Hope while I was in the governor's office. And a lot of this is about providing services to families in order to stay together and for both state agencies to help families, but in Restore Hope, the faith-based community was a big part of what he was trying to connect, and saying that there are faith-based organizations, even just individual churches, mm-hmm. who are ready to help, and the state agency cannot do it all ourselves. And so that was a big focus there, but I think it was a natural move then for him to move to juvenile justice after the child welfare, and he saw that there were some good things happening there. Mm-hmm. So, and it was about local communities getting the support they need.
And we only have 2 minutes left, and we could talk about this for much, much longer. But just final thoughts on what you hope and what the governor hopes that these reforms will accomplish in 5 years from now and 10 years from now. What will the juvenile justice system look like?
Well, I would say that the state agency part of it, especially the residential treatment, is much smaller. More of our services, more of our money is going to the local communities. There's local control that judges and community-based services get together and decide what they need, and then DYS and DHS can provide funding, support, and oversight.
So I would echo that. We fully believe that we would have a smaller system with children that, in fact, really need mm-hmm. intensive services from our division, and that many of our children in Arkansas will find themselves getting the services that they need in the community, in their homes, with their family, and keeping those families together.
No, that's what I was going to say.
Yeah. You all share the same vision.
Yeah, exactly.
We just have a lot of work to do, and that's what I would say. Yeah.
Well, thank you all so much for joining us, and Arkansas Advocates will be back next month. Thank you all so much.
Hi, this is Alanis Morissette, and you're listening to KABF 88.3 in Little Rock, the voice of the people.
Today on Wings.
What is nanotechnology?
Nanotechnology is the application of new knowledge that we're acquiring regarding the manipulation of very, very tiny particles, maybe 53 molecules, and at the nanoscale, that means bigger than atoms, but smaller than molecular biology. A strand of hair would be 80,000 nanometers.
Whoa.
In diameter.
A strand of hair would be 80,000 nanometers in diameter?
Yes.
Well, how do people even know that they're there?
Well, that's one of the major problems in regulating nanotechnology.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Elise Fitzan is the executive director of a think tank about health law called the Work, Health, and Survival Project. Herself a lawyer, she also holds a doctorate in international relations from the Geneva School of Diplomacy in Switzerland, where she wrote her dissertation on the possibility of regulating the now booming field of nanotechnology. I'm Frieda Worden. I interviewed Elise Fitzan by phone on March 10, 2016. She was on